So one of the great pleasures of practicing over many years is getting to know some wonderful, wonderful people and getting to walk this path with them. Melissa and I have known Jeannie for over 30 years, met in a quiet room. I knew Jeannie's socks before I knew her face. Such a pleasure to have Jeannie, who is now a senior Dharma teacher of Boundless Way, and a longtime teacher and a teacher at our retreats. She teaches yoga and saves our bodies, preaches the Dharma of of the body. But anyway, so happy to have you with us on retreat and now to have you up here with us.
So I just want to thank all of you who've been holding this space. I spent the beginning of Ongo in Florida listening to Dharma talks and Dharma dialogues, and so grateful, especially to Steve, who showed me how to burn them on CD. And I had this feeling, kind of like you guys were anchoring, reeling me in, bringing me to Worcester. I'm so glad to be here. And so listening to those Dharma talks and reading this piece, especially over the last few days, it's been striking me that Dogen's not giving us specific directions, but what he's doing with all four of these is sort of, it seems to me, inviting us into a stance of generosity and kindness and benevolent action and this identity action, which I really loved Melissa's definition she offered of friendliness. So that's how it appears to me. And I'm supposed to talk tonight about this fourth aspect, identity action. And the piece, that the line, the words that most pulled me were this wearying, not wearying. And I felt also, you know, as with the others, this not wearying in a way was holding the stance of friendliness, no matter what, no matter how bad things get. And very specifically for me, actually, quite a specific image rose for me when I read that word, was putting my kids to bed. There was a seemingly very long stretch of my life. It seemed to go on forever and ever when my kids were sort of school age, and I was being pretty much a single mom. My husband worked for a union. He was on call. He was gone every week, but often on weekends, and I was just kind of pulling it off somehow or other. And the very worst times of it were bedtime, when everybody was worn out and frayed at the edges, and somehow I got the job of being the cop, making sure homework happened and baths happened and bedtime happened on time. And the more I reread this section, the more I understand elements of what I was trying to do. And before I had words for it, it really was, in a sense, a stance of friendliness that I was aiming toward with my children and not wearying of them. This was particularly important to me because my upbringing was not great. I had a mom who was very violent. And when I was pregnant with my first child, I made a very deep vow to not repeat what had happened to me. And I didn't have so many words for it then, but my words for it at the time were just to hold them in love. Or at this point, just one kid. I didn't know there was going to be another one. To hold this one in love no matter what, and not do what my mom had done, which turned out to be not so easy, as I now know from experience and also reading, that we tend to repeat our family history. So in some ways it became my Zen practice, my spiritual practice, this holding of love, no matter what. There were also good times. I remember at bedtime of cuddling and reading together, very sweet memories. But my biggest challenge and what kind of forged me in a way, I don't know if that's the right word, but molded me, made me move into deep spiritual practice was this nightly stance of holding my children in love no matter what. And when they got pissy and they didn't want to do homework, and I remember my older daughter for a while, her line to me was, "You're not the boss of me, I choose my bedtime." I remember that. Emblazoned in my brain. And I had this impulse. I mean, I think because I was abused, it was in my muscles to get angry and to act out. And it took every ounce of me to remember my vow. And I also remember this mantra I had of, I think it was firm and kind, something like that, kind and firm. That's what I'd say to myself a lot. In reading this, you know, Dogen says you don't forget reward and punishment. It wasn't some kind of mushy love that I wanted with my children. I knew I had to set boundaries, but I wanted to do it kindly, which hadn't been modeled for me. So it was kind of a relearning, kind of a new neural pathway in a way, forging a new way. And Dogen also says, I think he says something like, in a proper manner, being appropriate. So for me, sometimes that was having fun with the kids, sometimes it was being the cop. And it was quite a dance. And there was some way, I didn't have words for it then, but there was some way I understood that what had happened with my mom, this anger she had and her violence, then affected me, and I was a bad kid. And we'd go back and forth like this, like it was done with mirrors, you know, this meanness. And I kind of knew that the buck had to stop here. I didn't want those mirrors to continue. And I have understood now as I get older, identity action. It's all done with mirrors. And the mirrors go backward. So it wasn't just my mom. My mom had a very violent dad. And so on, probably back through the generations. Who knows? I don't really know for sure, but I'm guessing. And the mirrors go forward, that how I treated my kids was how they were going to treat me, how they were going to treat themselves, how they were going to treat their kids. I knew this on some level, and that it was my responsibility to sit right in the middle of all those mirrors and breathe a lot. So I think at the very end of this piece, Dogen says something like a gentle expression of identity action. And that was my goal. That was my deep Zen practice at nighttime with my children. Not wearying of them, remembering to love them no matter what. And that has served me well. It's funny, I actually just now, when we just read this piece, in some ways, Dogen talks about that mirror stuff. He talks about the ruler and the people, and the people not realizing it, that they support the ruler. And I realize, that's another mirror. You know, that we are so connected in ways that we sometimes don't see. And it's each of our responsibility to not weary of each other, to hold this friendliness, this loving kindness, because the ripple effects will happen and we don't always know quite what they're going to be. I think that's just what I want to say.
Thank you.
I think we all know how to do this Dharma dialogue thing. Please make yourselves comfortable. I'm Melissa.
Steve.
Fran.
Pete.
Abraham.
Faye.
Diane.
David.
Jeannie.
It sounds like you were realizing the way and the Dharma even before you were really introduced to it. And when you tell your story about working with kindness and trying to break those old patterns that go a long time back, that it's really a way of having your life become your practice. And to me, that's also really a cone and a reminder that it's life itself that's practice. It's on the cushion, and it's really, that's perhaps when it's the easiest practice, but breaking old patterns, that's the essence of true transformation. So really appreciate that very honest story also, and the courage to tell it.
Actually, for me, I'd had many years of Zen practice before I had children. I had them when I was elderly.
Middle-aged.
But, you know, as you said, you know, sitting on the cushion was a breeze compared to that. And that, I often said to myself, this is graduate school of Zen practice, you know, this real life raising children. And I was quite pissy at the time, but I'm very grateful for that opportunity. It did forge me.
Would it be fair to say, Jeannie, I mean, with the three of us started with the same teacher, and Diane was a student of that same person, and the emphasis wasn't so much on integration of daily life, so there was, Zen was just about sitting. And then you got up and, you know, did what you did. And so, you know, in a way, you really, I think Pete caught some flavor of, you really discovered Zen when you had kids. I mean, that was the true spirit of compassion and being a bodhisattva.
Kicking and screaming.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm really doing that really hard work.
Yeah.
Thanks for sharing. And I know I was a perfect child at bedtime. I just really love this idea of sort of the people of the country are, you know, the Lord doesn't know, but they're holding him up the same. And also it really brought to mind this idea of sort of like roles, and I was just reflecting on just in my community, sort of like I take on this role, not necessarily the Lord at all, but and somehow by like creating this identity, it's just like completely taken apart by the support system of all the other identities. So it's sort of a tricky, interesting thing to, when you try to create an identity in a group of people, it's actually taken apart more often, and you can sort of see that.
So you're playing a particular role and people don't want you to play that role, and
or they do, or they're supportive, and just seeing the relationship of them supporting me.
That it's all together,
right?
You're all creating it. Yeah. I think that, and that so strikes me too, because oftentimes it looks like one person is creating the role. Well, you know, you're the boss, so you do it, but the boss can only be the boss if there are other people that agree that she's the boss, you know, or whatever the agreement happens to be. And same way with parent. I mean, you can't be a parent if there's not some... Everybody has to cooperate in those things. And so it's everybody's supporting everybody else.
Mm-hmm. And the Zen teacher.
And a Zen teacher, right, especially.
Well, I was thinking that so much when you were talking. Yeah, that Dogen's pointing to that too. I would just be sitting here by myself.
I'd be like that.
Yeah, a party of one. But yeah, there's something co-created. The Sangha is co-created, definitely. There's, you know, I said that the other day in a talk. I can't do this by myself. There's some way that we cooperate, and that is identity. It just feels very clear. Yeah. But often when we're in the middle of when we're caught in the role, we're not so clear.
Yeah. Abe, did you want to say something directly to
this? Yeah. It's funny, sort of, one of my problems when just mentioning the idea of mirroring and you know, seeing yourself reflected back in certain situations. I think immediately of my living situation, where I live with 17 people in my building, and it is your mood is reflected back in you instantaneously, and it's a practice, you know, it really is a practice where you really do have to be mindful of what you're throwing out there, because it gets returned to you like that, and it really has been an amazing opportunity to kind of learn about that.
Yeah.
Amazing is a good word.
But I think it's one of the great benefits of any kind of leadership role is that it's like living with the volume turned up.
Right.
You know, so if you're by yourself and you're kind of in a shitty mood and you don't get much back, but if you're interacting with people and you're like this, you begin to know it quickly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's very difficult, but such an opportunity.
So rewarding.
Yeah. To
have all
to use
mirrors.
That.
Mm. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
Diane?
Well, just to continue that, you know, I realized today, I should have realized it before, but I definitely would not have been able to sit this Angha without all of you. I would have quit the first time I got sick. I would have quit the first time I just got really tired, you know, but because we're all doing it together, it's like, you know, I mean, it's not even a thought that occurs, like, oh, I gotta do this, everybody else is here, you know. It's really just, you just feel that everyone is, you know, holding up everybody else, and so sometimes one falls, sometimes the other does, but, you know, it's, you really can't do it alone, you know, you really can't. So, and true for all of life, right? I was also going to say, Jeannie, when you were talking about anger, so that's come up quite a bit in our Dharma talks this week. So, in response to the Boston Marathon bombings, you know, and we've had a lot of really rich discussions about how we need to acknowledge our own anger, you know, what the possibility of anger in ourselves and the reality of it. But quite a difference between, you know, experiencing it and acting out. So there's, you know, sort of the bodhisattva action of, you know, can we interrupt that action or... So you know, you did that. You
mostly.
So under such, you know, difficult circumstances, mm-hmm. you know, rising to the challenge. So.
Well, and I think this is what we're doing on the cushion, mm-hmm. too. You know, the ancient patterns of greed, anger, and ignorance. Mm-hmm. You know, those ancient neural pathways that we've all been taught. And as you were talking about the raising your daughters, first of all, I was so touched just, you know, thinking of being a parent and remembering those incredibly challenging and precious times. You know, and I think we all have times like that, whether we're parents or not, looking back at our life and just the richness of where we've been. But this idea of taking a vow of nonviolence towards ourselves, I like this, what, firm and gentle. All right, David, come back to the breath. You know? But it really does take that, and over again, the old programming wants to come in, and it takes some clear intention, you know, over time. We're raising ourselves. And also trying not to get weary of ourselves. Mm-hmm. You know, oh, you again. Oh, God. You know, one more time, the troublesome parts of me arise. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we sort of hold each other together as we, you know, are exhausted and just totally fed up with ourselves at some point, you know. And yet... to take this bodhisattva vow of, you know, being present, some kind of cultivating this compassionate awareness, but also staying on track. You know, there's work to be done here.
What does weary mean?
Weary, you are very tired. Okay. With a kind of like, oh.
So the Lord never gets tired of his people.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
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 You know, I was thinking that I never knew your mother, only heard about her from you, but I know you, and I know me, and I know, you know, my own daughter, David. I know the arising of anger, and when I used to work with people who had been abused or who were abusers, what I'm suspecting, and this I hadn't really met, this wasn't clear until I heard you speaking, that great vow you took was dependent upon you really owning anger arising and the consequences of it. Mm-hmm. And with someone who's abusive, there's not an ownership. Mm-hmm. In fact, the mm-hmm. anger starts to arise, and in order to avoid that horrible feeling, there's a striking out. Mm-hmm. So that's you know, the bodhisattva activity of your mother was brief, probably, right? Because she could only tolerate it maybe for a few seconds, a minute. It had to leap outward into mm-hmm. destruction. Mm-hmm. But you had the same bodhisattva activity, but it just was a little bit wider, so that you could be awake to the consequences.
Yeah, as I get older, I'm very aware of the privileges I had that my mother didn't have,
right. Right.
that gave me that little extra wedge,
yeah.
right?
It's karma. Right?
To have Zen practice, mm-hmm. to be able to go to therapy, mm-hmm. to have nonviolent communication training, you know. Like,
yeah,
exactly. So you know, you can be grateful for that little smidgen of moment that she was able to, and grateful for how you expanded it. And we can all do that, you know. That this is not about trying to be good, and you know, I'm not going to get angry, but to really feel the anger, and then as much as possible not act on it. And of course, if we do act on it, because sometimes we do, to recognize that too, and to say whoa, and stop. You know, so we are very lucky to be able to do that.
Yeah.
and to forgive ourselves. That was a theme that came up early on in the Angha when we were talking about generosity, this quality of forgiveness that we can also have towards just being ordinary humans who get angry, scared, despair.
I think it's pretty hard to get that that viewpoint sometimes. I was thinking about, you know, my own family history, and it wasn't really so much physical violence, but my father's whole family is just incredibly intense and terrorize, you know, everyone around them. And I can remember as a child thinking, you know, I just don't understand this. I am never going to be like this. You know, I would never treat people this way. Just absolutely terrorizing my family. And you know, the older I get, the easier it is for me to relate to, you know, the pressures that my father was under. I mean, his father died when he was 22 or something and left him with the family business. And he suddenly had to, you know, take over supporting this family business. And he eventually failed at it. You know, it took quite a while, but he mortgaged the house and took all the family money and threw it all into the business and eventually lost. And yeah, imagine the stress that, you know, that he was under, you know, doing all that. And he has had obviously the same sort of irritable nature that I see in myself, you know, and here he was under all this, you know, this incredible stress and the background of his family that is so dysfunctional. And later in life, I could really, you know, see this same kind of thing coming up in me and really being able to identify, you know, what was up with him at the time. And still, you know, to have some pride in myself that I didn't, you know, necessarily act out in quite the same way that he did, but nonetheless, you know, very clearly able to see, you know, where he was coming from and how it must have been for him. Unfortunately, much too late. I mean, he like most of his family, all died young.
I want to share something. When I was thinking about all this stuff, I remembered this article I read once in a social work magazine. It was about therapy, and it was saying that really, if we're going to do deep-rooted therapy, we have to not only heal ourselves, but we have to heal our parents and our grandparents. Literally, I mean, that was the form of therapy, and that because our grandparents live in us, our parents live in us, and just what you were saying, that I can't remember the word, intensity, or no, there's another word.
Irritability.
You know, it's sort of like, you know, I've had a lot of ahas, and then I have to go back, and I actually have written many stories about my grandma, who was beaten by her husband, of standing up to him, you know, like healing her, so I could heal myself.
The generations we have any idea about.
Well, I think it's important because we're in a Zen setting here to remember that we all have family histories, and everyone on the planet has family histories, and that there's this great history of suffering, and that in some way it's really not personal.
Right.
You know, part of what our obligation is, I think, as students of the way, is to really see, when this is bodhisattva action, we're not just healing our parents and grandparents. This is what saving all beings means. It's not, while it is unique and particular to each one of us, and we could all tell our stories of our families, it is actually the way the world spins.
Karma.
It is karma. It is causes and conditions, all inextricably linked. So our vow, you know, you spoke about vow in your talk, really has to be, I think, to wake up to this and recognize it. that every single person on the planet has a long line back of explanation. Mm-hmm. You know, right, going back years and years and years, centuries and centuries, millennia. And here, right now, in this moment, we get to be awake. And that's all we can do. Mm-hmm. And that, in a flash, heals the world. Mm-hmm. Not in some smarmy way, but in this very resonant way. And irritability, intensity, violence, it's life unfolding in a constricted manner. So this, we open to it and we stop making it so small, and then it becomes bodhicitta. It becomes our the fire of our practice.
Yeah. Well, and there's what someone was saying in one of the other Dharma talks about. She was talking about coming here and feeling transformed and going to work, and everyone at work had been transformed. Mm-hmm. But I love that image of the mirrors, mm-hmm. you know, and the power of our zazen is not just in us, but it, you know, the whole world sits with us. Mm-hmm. And we change the course of human history.
Mm-hmm. That's how you save all beings, man. Right.
With mirrors.
With mirrors.
And smoke.
Well, and then there's the, Dogen said the whole world is the self.
Yeah.
And George talked about this great round mirror. Mm. You know, we sometimes say the whole world is a great round mirror, and when anger comes in front of the mirror reflects anger. Mm-hmm. When love and vow come in front of the mirror, it reflects that. And the great gift of this world that meets us, you know, like as leaders, you know, the great gift of this reflection back, so we can know who we are and have some possibility.
Did you have something else?
Well, it was just to you just reminded me, well, I think it's really true. It is the way to save ourselves and the world. There's this book by Shantideva, The Way of the Bodhisattva. Mm-hmm. And you would think, I thought at first when I was going to read it, well, this is really about helping other people. And there's nothing about that at all. It's all about working with yourself.
Yeah.
But it really makes good sense
yeah.
when you sort of look at it in this context with these examples. And yeah. and but it's you sort of have to understand it before it really makes sense. And then it just becomes, this is true.
Yeah. Right. And of course, Dogen himself says to study the way is to study the self, and to study the self is to forget the self. So there is this self and other identity that just becomes obvious, but you have to start with what you have, which is this.
Yeah.
So, mm-hmm. so and that's the entryway.
Yeah.
And I think it's the section before this, but Dogen talks about helping the ignorant people. Mm. And one of our speakers pointed out that the ignorant people are us. We need to help a beneficial action toward our many ignorant people that we are. And actually the good news about that is that we're actually the only person we have hardly any influence over at all. You know, not that we have very much, it seems to me. But at least if I locate the problem inside rather than outside, there's some possibility of being with it or learning or changing my position rather than spending my life trying to get people outside me to be different. So some great news there in this co-creation that then our intention and our action has an incredible impact. And then it's up to me, you know, yikes, kind of, but also, wow, there's something to turn to there.
So, thank you.